The book of Zephaniah was written by the prophet Zephaniah sometime between 635 and 625 BC. Zephaniah writes about the judgment coming to Judah, as well as their neighboring countries. King Josiah had made great efforts to reform Judah's social and spiritual practices, but the nation was set in their sinful patterns. For years, the prophet Zephaniah warned that the Lord would send a powerful army to sweep through their lands and destroy Jerusalem on account of their sins. But God's judgment would not be limited to Judah. Zephaniah lists the surrounding nations and counts them all as guilty. Alongside this bleak message, Zephaniah calls for the people to seek the Lord and be spared by his mercy. This faithful remnant would one day be counted righteous by their faith and ultimately see the fulfillment of God's promises.
Hello, people who don't own a cottage. It's our weekend. This is my last weekend teaching before I go on sabbatical, and so I'm glad I got to spend it with my Memorial Day crowd. So thanks for coming to church today. Let's start by talking about the fact that church is weird. Can we just admit it? There's a whole lot of weird stuff that we do when we gather as a church. Think about it. Quite frequently, we get together, and in this room, we take a tiny little meal. That's weird, right? We drink a tiny little cup, and we eat a tiny little piece of bread, and we say that this tiny little cup and this piece of bread represent the body and blood of our God. From the outside, that's really weird. We do baptisms, which is pretty much taking a bath with your clothes in front of your church family. Weird. It's even weirder on Easter when you spend 5 hours getting ready for church and then you ruin your entire look in like 3 seconds. It's weird. We spend time every week looking at a thousands of year old book saying that not only does it apply to our lives and we should live as it tells us, but that it is the very words of God. That's weird. And then the weirdest thing we do, at least in my mind, is when we get together, we sing. Isn't that kind of weird? It's like the one time in our week where our entire lives just break into a musical. It's like High School Musical just happens in the middle of our week. We stand and we start singing, and we don't think it's weird that we're doing it, but it's really weird that we're doing it. I mean, why is it that we get together and sing like this? I mean, singing together is something that humans have always done. In fact, I was doing some research on it this week, and I found that before the Industrial Revolution, a lot of workplaces were filled with singing, that the employers would have their employees sing because it increased productivity and morale and all that, and people would sing during work until the Industrial Revolution when the machines were too loud for you to hear the people singing, and that was the end of singing at work. Singing together is something that people have always done, and we still do it. I mean, right down the street at the MSU Spartan Stadium, people sing. We sing the national anthem. Whenever this fight song comes on, we sing the fight song together. It is something that humans do. And so the question is, why do we do it? Is it just an evolutionary impulse like a bird chirping? It is actually something way, way bigger, and I found it in the book of Zephaniah. And so in the book of Zephaniah, I think I see a profound reason why we sing. So let me put this book into context. Zephaniah falls in an interesting place in the timeline of the Old Testament prophets, because a lot of the prophets that we've been covering, they did their prophecy either during the fall of Jerusalem by the Babylonians or during the captivity period in the Babylonians. But this book, Zephaniah, was written way before all of that. And because we've been teaching one message out of every book in the Bible, we've had to skip a lot of detail. And one of the things that we skipped was the story of a guy named Josiah. In fact, the only venue that has the leg up on the rest of us is our West Side venue, because in December, Tony taught on Josiah, but the rest of us didn't hear about Josiah because his story is in 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, and we just kind of leapt over that in telling the narrative. And so here's the story of King Josiah. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king. I want you to think of any 8-year-old you know and imagine handing them the throne, saying, you are now in charge. And then just let that settle in. He was an 8-year-old king. And then when he was 16 years old, he went through a little bit of a spiritual renewal. And he got very excited about this idea of seeking after God, which I want you to imagine a 16-year-old. And by the way, I've met a lot of 16-year-olds who that's about the time they start getting excited about their faith. And so about 16 years old, Josiah begins to seek after God. And by the time he is 20, he begins to lead a major reform within the nation of Judah there, instituting all kinds of renewal, spiritual renewal. He rebuilt the temple. He restarted worship. And this massive spiritual revival happened under Josiah's reign. Well, Zephaniah was part of all that. He was right in the middle of all of that. And one of the things you'll notice in the Bible and you'll notice in our lives is that often when God starts to do something in this world, he starts to stir things up spiritually. He does it with more than one person at the same time. We saw this with Moses. God calls Moses and said, listen, I want you to go in to Egypt, and I want you to tell the Pharaoh to let my people go. And Moses had this huge fight with God in Exodus about that. And then God's like, listen, here comes your brother Aaron. He's on his way. And he hadn't seen his brother Aaron in a long time, but God had been working on Aaron as well to get Aaron there with Moses. The same thing happened with Saul, who became the Apostle Paul. On the road to Damascus, Jesus appears to him, and there's this blinding vision, and he tells him that his life is going to be different from that moment on. And the first thing he does is he says, go to town, meet a guy named Ananias. I've already been preparing Ananias for you. It's the same thing with Mary and Jesus's mom and Elizabeth, her cousin, who was the mom of John the Baptist. They were pregnant at the same time. God was doing something. So often, God is stirring the hearts of multiple people at the same time when he is going to do something. And I believe that's what's happening with Josiah and Zephaniah. Josiah was the king, and Zephaniah was the prophet, and God was stirring them up to bring this revival into their town, and their messages are remarkably similar. You can summarize Josiah's message, Zephaniah's message in Zephaniah 2, where it says this. It says, seek the Lord, all you humble of the land who do his just commands. Seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you may be hidden on the day of the anger of the Lord. Now, if you summarize that statement even further, you can just see his core message was seek the Lord, seek righteousness, seek humility. And that was the core little catchy message that you'll see through both Josiah and Zephaniah's a message to the people is just seek the Lord, seek righteousness, seek humility. When the rest of the world is doing other things, you seek God. When the rest of the world has got injustice, you seek righteousness. When the world is prideful and arrogant, you seek humility. It is this great little pithy statement. When I was looking at that, I recalled over my life these moments where I can remember spiritually God doing things in my life and in the culture around us, and it was always wrapped around a simple, radical idea. Something like, seek the Lord, seek righteousness, seek humility. Back in when I started attending RIV, so like 20-some-odd years ago, Pastor Steve Summerlott would often wrap up his sermons by saying, maybe, just maybe, God will use us to reach the world one more time. And there's something about that little simple, poignant message grabbed my heart and my soul. In the 1990s, I don't know if you remember the WWJD bracelets. You know, what would Jesus do? They were all over the place. In fact, I saw one last week. I was like, whoa, those are still around. I was totally shocked. But in the 90s, especially amongst young people, there was this excitement around that idea. In the early 2000s, there's this 116 movement from Romans 1:16. I am not ashamed of the gospel of Jesus Christ. There's these simple little radical statements that I think God uses sometimes to stir up a revival in a time. And I wonder if this idea of seek the Lord, seek righteousness, seek humility was a simple summary that helped propel what God was doing there in Judah. If you read through Zephaniah 2 and you read Zephaniah 3, you begin to see Zephaniah's description of what it would be like on the day of the anger of the Lord, and specifically what it would be like and how it would be different for those who do seek the Lord, who seek righteousness, who seek humility. Because on that day when this Messiah, this king would come to reign, this is what the world would be like for them. Chapter 3, verse 9, he says, "For at that time I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech." Let's just stop there. Think about that for a second. Throughout the Bible, there's a consistent message that words matter. James, who was probably Jesus' half-brother, said words are like a tiny little rudder on a big ship that could steer the ship anywhere you want. He said words are like a tiny little bit you put in a horse's mouth that you can steer the horse wherever you want. He says words are like a tiny little flame that can set a forest on fire. Words can lift up and words can tear down. Careless words can cut and maim. And what Zephaniah says is on that day, when the Lord comes, when he establishes his kingdom, when everything gets set up, at that time, I will change the speech of the people to a pure speech. I will change their words. I will change how they speak. And the best use of how they speak is that all of them may call upon the name of the Lord. It's what they will do with their words. "And serve him with one accord. From beyond the rivers of Cush, my worshipers, the daughter of my dispersed ones, shall bring my offering. On that day, you shall not be put to shame because of the deeds by which you have rebelled against me." Did you catch that last sentence? Let me reread it because it may not actually make sense. He says, on that day of the anger of the Lord, on the day of the anger of the Lord, you shall not be put to shame because of the deeds by which you have rebelled against me. So here's what he's saying. He's saying, you have rebelled against God. You have done evil, sinful things. The day of the anger of the Lord is coming, and you will not be put to shame on that day. This is the radical beauty of the gospel of Jesus. In reflecting on all these old messages that had kind of jumped into my heart through my life, I went back and reread an old book recently by a guy named Brendan Manning. It's called Ragamuffin Gospel, that I read years and years ago. And this is a guy who, he described himself as an angel with an incredible capacity for beer. The guy who wrote this, and I just took a picture of the page. I don't have it on the screen because I just was reading it yesterday. Here's what he says. He says, God has a single relentless stance toward us. I want you to think about that for a second. Imagine God setting his feet. He is a single relentless stance toward us. He loves us. He loves us. He is the only God man has ever heard of who loves sinners. False gods, the gods of human manufacturing, despise sinners. But the Father of Jesus loves all. But of course, this is almost too incredible for us to accept. Nevertheless, the central affirmation of the Reformation stands. Though through no merit of ours, but by his mercy, we have been restored to right relationship with God through the life, death, and resurrection of his beloved Son. This is the good news. This is the gospel of grace. And what Zephaniah didn't realize is as he was talking about this once future king that would come, he was talking about Jesus. When he was talking about this day that even though you have rebelled against God, even though you have committed evil sins against God, it will not be held against you. That on the day of the anger of the Lord, you shall not be put to shame. He was declaring the gospel of Jesus because your sins do deserve shame. But because of Jesus, that shame is erased. Listen as he continues with this theme. He says, for then I will remove from your midst the proudly exultant ones, and you shall no longer be haughty in my holy mountain. But I will leave in your midst a people humble and lowly. They shall seek refuge in the name of the Lord. Those who are left in Israel, they shall do no injustice and speak no lies, nor shall there be found in their mouth a deceitful tongue, for they shall graze and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Listen to the contrast. He's contrasting those who call upon the name of the Lord with those who are proudly exultant. Those who take refuge in the Lord with those who are haughty on God's holy mountain. See, what he's saying is that the key, even in the Old Testament, was faith. It was calling on the name of the Lord. And he gives this future vision of this time where none shall make them afraid. Think about that. None shall make them afraid. Just this week. I mean, just think of what happened this week. I didn't even have to do any research. I just wrote down the first three things that popped into mind. School shootings, where one kid said, I expected this to happen. There was a video that came out of cops that tased a black NBA star a couple months ago, for a parking violation. And then there were cops that were falsely accused of sexual assault that if there wasn't body cam imagery, who knows what would have happened to those guys, and they were exonerated because of the body cam. I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter whether you're a cop or an NBA player or a kid in school. Those are the first three that popped to mind. There's more, right? I mean, just there's so much in this world to be afraid of. There's so much evil in this world. And yet, what does he say? He says, for they shall graze and lie down, and none shall make them afraid. Early in the morning, I was driving my son to Michigan State last week, and all the cows were sleeping in the field. And I was thinking about how just they don't care. They're just happy. They're not afraid. They're not worried. They're sleeping in the grass. And that's the image here. The image is being at so peace that you can just be walking through the fields and go, you know what? It's nap time. And just lay down and take a nap because there's nothing to be afraid of. There's this future image that there's nothing to be afraid of. And when you get that, when you begin to grasp that, the reaction that we ought to have is a hope and a faith-filled response. And we see it in verse 14. He says this, sing aloud, O daughter of Zion, shout, O Israel, rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The Lord has taken away the judgments against you. He has cleared away your enemies. The King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. You shall never again fear evil. A lot of times the best way to make sense of Scripture is to work it backward. So let's work that one backward. What does he say? You shall never again fear evil. I know all of that stuff is happening in this world that is can cause fear, but there's going to be a day where you'll never have to fear evil because the King of Israel, the Lord, is in your midst. Because there will be this day where Jesus will physically be with his people, and when he is, it's like, I don't even know how to even begin to describe that. It's like being a little kid and dad comes home. All right. I mean, that's just like a little image of that. A good dad who is a protective dad. Now, some of us have not had that kind of a dad, and I understand that. But the idea of dad, the protector being there, you're like, I don't have to be afraid. He's here. Things are good, right? And so this image that when Jesus is here and he's with his people, you shall never fear evil. The Lord has taken away the judgments against you. He has cleared away your enemy. He has taken away the judgments against you. This is what Jesus has done. He has taken away all the judgments against you. There is no shame that you need to face. The future reality is when you see him, you will not have to be afraid. On the day of the anger of the Lord, you will have nothing to fear. Because Jesus has taken away the judgments against you. So sing aloud, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O Israel. Rejoice and exult with all your heart, O daughter of Jerusalem. The appropriate response to the magnificent future that Jesus guarantees is going to happen, that inevitable future where there is no shame and there is no fear. The appropriate response is to break into song. It is for life to become a musical. It is the pure joy of singing because everything is going to be all right. If you don't believe me that this is the normal human response, just go to Wrigley Field in Chicago. If you are not into baseball, A, what's wrong with you? B, you won't understand this, so let me explain it. In Wrigley Field in Chicago, every time the Chicago Cubs win, they hoist a W flag above Wrigley Field. It says W for the win. And everyone in the stadium and everyone watching the game on TV sings a song together. And it's a corny, cheesy song. Go Cubs, go. Go Cubs, go. I won't sing the rest of it, but it is like any Chicago Cubs fan knows every word of that song. There's this exultant moment where you got these 50-year-old union drywallers singing with every breath that they have about the fact that the Cubs just won. You go to the Boston Red Sox at Fenway, and in the eighth inning, you will sing Sweet Caroline. It is what happens in a heart filled with joy. And if a baseball game can cause that, how much more should we sing because of what Jesus has done for us? And it's not just Zephaniah. There's at least 185 recorded songs that I could find in the Bible. And there's other places where there's things that are quoted that are probably songs, but they're not necessarily listed quite as songs. There's at least 185. In Exodus 15, we have probably the first recorded song. The first recorded song was Moses' song. And Moses was singing. He just broke into song about this future restoration that God was going to do. He looked down the corridors of time and he sang a song about that. And then in Revelation 15, that same song is quoted. And it's the last song quoted in Scripture. And it not only says that it's the song of Moses, it says it is the song of the Lamb. So Moses, when he was singing in Exodus 15, didn't realize he was singing about Jesus. And then John tells us in Revelation, that song and all these other songs, they are about Jesus and what Jesus is going to do. Solomon wrote 1,005 songs. Paul and Silas, while they were sitting in prison, imprisoned for their faith, they sang songs. In the book of Revelation, 144,000 messianic Jews, along with people from every tribe, tongue, and nation, sing to Jesus. The Bible is filled with songs. And the Bible tells us to sing. In Psalm 96, it says, oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord. Bless his name. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Sing to the Lord a new song. It's why I love it when people come up to me and say, I didn't recognize that worship song. Where did that come from? We wrote it. Someone in our church family wrote that song. It's singing to the Lord a new song. It is what we do in Colossians. It tells us to sing to each other. That let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in all wisdom, singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs with thankfulness in your hearts to God. Why do we sing? It is so weird. Well, the first reason we sing is because God tells us to. And honestly, that ought to be enough. But I found in Zephaniah another more profound reason that we sing. It's in chapter 3, verse 16, where Zephaniah says this, on that day it shall be said to Jerusalem, fear not, O Zion, let not your hands grow weak. The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love. He will exult over you with loud singing. Why do we sing? Because we are created in the image of God and he sings. Look at what this passage says. It says, the day is coming when God will rejoice over you with gladness. Now think about that for a second. He is going to sing over you. He is going to quiet you. Think of a lullaby. And he will exult over you with loud singing. That's the opposite of a lullaby. The day is coming when God will see you and he will be so overjoyed at spending an eternity with you that he will burst into song like Zac Efron. Right? This is what is in High School Musical and The Greatest Showman, not like Zac Efron and Baywatch. It's a totally different God image there. But let this sink in for a moment. Just get this. God will be so excited to spend eternity with you that he will not be able to contain himself. And he doesn't sing over you to worship you. He sings over you because you are evidence of his glory. The fact that in your deepest, darkest sin, you know the one. He saved you. When you couldn't save yourself, he sent Jesus. When your eternity had a trajectory away from him for all eternity, he turned that around in Jesus, and you showing up in glory is evidence to his glory. I've got a really bad example, but it's the best one I got. Every time I mow my lawn, I'm that guy. Like, I've got a whole pattern built. Like, I know that, like, I've got this alternating pattern so I don't, like, put, like, little too bad of stripes in my yard the way I don't want them. And I mow different ways. And so yeah, when I mow my backyard, I have to figure out kind of how I'm going to do it that day. And then the first thing I do when I get done mowing my yard is I go up to my bedroom. And my bedroom is on the second story. And we have a basement, too, that kind of extends it. So it's, like, up over my great kingdom in the backyard. And I look out of my back window at my perfectly mowed yard. And I say to myself, I did this. Look at my grass, right? And so I do. I stand there. And true story. I usually don't throw my arms out, but at least I go, all right, I'll give it a little look. And then I head to the shower, right? So I always give it a look before I clean up. Now, that is me looking at this and saying, I did this. When God exults over you with gladness, when he exults over you with loud singing, it is him looking over his redeemed people and saying, I did this. I get the glory for this. They can't take any of the glory. I get the glory. But then he exults over you in singing. May I give you a challenge today, and it's a little bit of the pot calling the kettle black. There are times at Riv where we're kind of lame when it comes to our singing. And part of it is, it's just how we are. Like, we're singing, it's Lansing, right? I mean, it is though. Dude, I'll go to a bar and I'll go watch a band and everybody will be standing around like this going. And then afterwards you're like, what did you think? And they're like, "Is my favorite concert I've ever been to." So part of it is like, okay, I get it. This is Lansing. And part of it is our personalities. And part of it is, I know it's a little bit embarrassing to sing, but especially for those of us who can't carry a tune. I remember when I was a kid, I would sit in the pew next to my dad. And my dad, as politely as I can say this, could not find the melody with GPS. He could not carry a tune with a bucket. Come up with as many metaphors as you want. My dad can't sing. And my dad would sing. And my challenge to those of you, especially those of you who are dads, there was something in my tiny little soul that moved when my dad sang in church. May I challenge us to sing? If you're awed by what Jesus has done for you, sing it. If the words strike you in the song, that's a prayer. Sing it. We keep it loud enough that most people can't hear you anyway. Now be yourself. Don't be weird. I'm not asking you to be something you're not. So just be yourself, but sing. Be who you are and sing. And today you may have noticed we pushed everything to the front of the service. The offering's out of the way, announcements out of the way. All we got left is singing. So we're going to sing. And you have no excuses. I wrapped up early. Jude, I didn't put my watch on today. I am really ready for sabbatical. We have time. You don't have a cottage. You have nowhere to go. So let's sing. Let's sing together. We're going to do, I'll even just tell you right now, we're going to do four songs. We're going to do four songs. Would you stay for all of it? Would you not rush off to get coffee? Would you not rush off to get your kid? Would you just sing and spend this time reflecting on what Jesus has done for you? I'm going to read a song to you to start, Psalm 96. Would you stand with me? And we're going to read this, and then we're going to sing. The psalmist says this, "Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name. Tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the peoples are worthless idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens be glad and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Let all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness." Amen.